Our next speaker is Kerry Woolfall. She's a social scientist and a senior lecturer at the University of Liverpool. Her study interest is looking at patient and family and clinician perspectives to help inform the design of clinical trials. So thank you.
Hello. So back in 2008, in the UK, legislation was amended to enable research to be conducted without prior consent in emergency situations. So this happened in the last decade in numerous countries, and each has its own legislation and variants. But essentially, is resource research, we are allowed to enter a child, randomise into a clinical trial, and then seek consent after. The legislation itself lacks a bit of detail, so on the screen here is essentially the elements that are in the UK legislation. So we didn't know quite a lot, just the practicalities about how this can be conducted, and also there were queries about, is anyone using it? So I came into the post in the University of Liverpool around 2010, and it was a new area for me. I didn't know that much about clinical trials, and I was attached to a CTU, the group that I work with, and was handed some minutes from the CATCH trial. And CATCH was looking at catheter infections in children. And we were, in that meeting, they were discussing the fact they didn't have much evidence about how to write the protocol, about what parents thought would be okay. And they'd noted how anxious practitioners felt about conducting research without prior consent. And those anxieties linked to, well, how will parents actually react to being told their children's already been entered into a trial? And what should happen if a child dies before consent has been sought and before the parents know anything about their participation in research? So we set about putting a grant application together for Wellcome Trust, and it was part of my postdoc. And then about 6 months later, I had twins at 28 weeks. And got first-hand experience of being recruited to 4 clinical trials in emergency situations. I was thrilled. It was really difficult situation. My friend thought I was bonkers, and my family were like, what? She's getting excited. But it was. So this is James. This is the first time I held James. He was 2.5 weeks at this point. The smile says one thing, but the eyes say something else. His brother Ethan was 2 rooms down, and fighting for his life, and continued to do so for a number of months. And it was at various points in this process that we were asked to take part in different studies. And despite my gung-ho attitude to, I will take part in any research whatsoever, it soon became quite clear that my capacity to take on information, my partner's willingness to say yes to everything, and just trying to weigh up the risks and benefits of everything was quite overwhelming. So I took all this away and began to develop topic guides for what became the Connect study and the information. So it was quite useful. And the children are now 8 and fabulous, by the way. So thank you for the Liverpool Women's Hospital. So the Connect study was the first study to actually look into this and find out what practitioners, parents, and at that point we also wanted to find out what children thought about research without prior consent. And we found that there was support in general for this. We did a national survey to begin with, and it was people understood that we could not get fully informed consent in that situation. Those practitioners who took part in CATCH, which turned out to be the only trial at that point in time that was using it, said that they did have those anxieties, but then actually they found that nearly all parents were receptive. There were some exceptions, and there were still those concerns about, is this ethically appropriate, and what do parents think? So we asked parents. We asked them in the CATCH cohort, and we also asked wider groups of parents whose children who'd been involved in emergency medicine in some way. And there were a lot of them said they were shocked to find out that this was possible to do, and they thought it was a bit strange. Some of the parents in CATCH said that they were shocked, some were a little bit angry, but this was momentary. And as soon as the reasons why research without prior consent was used, then was explained by practitioners, then they said that they completely understood and they supported it. But there were some buts there, and the buts were related to the actual nature of the clinical trial. So CATCH looked at in catheters. It wasn't a drug trial. The three catheters that were used in CATCH were used across the UK. There was nothing new, nothing risky they perceived to be, so that made it all right. So there were quotes from parents saying, well, I wouldn't want my child to be like a guinea pig, came up. So we developed guidance, and we'd also interviewed bereaved parents. So the Connect guidance, it's available online. If you just Google my surname, I've got a strange surname, it comes up with Connect Study. And it has a number of sections, including how to design a trial, how to write the consent process into your protocol, and also what should happen if a child dies, and how options of how to handle that situation. So that was now 2015. And we started, or had started, what was to be the first CTIMP, so the first trial of drugs, which would use research without prior consent in the UK. So some of you might be familiar with CLIPS, you might have even recruited parents or children to a CLIPS. And it was across 30 hospitals, it was a big first Perucki-led study. And we embedded the Connect guidance into the training for staff. But then there were still some concerns remained, and this concern was due to the lack of experience, really, that they could see the evidence, and it was like, okay, in CATCH they thought it would be okay, but would it be okay to this? And Eclipse was looking at levetiracetam versus phenytoin for the treatment of long-lasting seizures. And levetiracetam wasn't really used in the ED, so that was a slight concern. And there was also the practicalities of, what about weekends? How are we going to cover consent seeking at weekends? That came up in all the site training visits. And particular concerns about how parents would react in resus. So what about those children who are regular attenders? And those parents know what usually happens in the ED, they're going to notice we're doing something different. How are we going to deal with that when we're trying to resuscitate a child? There were really valid concerns, which we hoped we'd addressed, but we felt that, you know, we would try and give the confidence and run the trial and see how it goes. The trial was a success. It's recently finished and has just been published in The Lancet. We recruited on time and to target, despite these concerns. So we had an embedded study throughout the trial to try and find out how this all panned out. And we had a lot of data. I think the most interesting data that we have are the recorded trial discussions. A lot of people were anxious about recording trial discussions between parents, but we're so glad that they did, because we also interviewed those parents afterwards and brought the data together. We also interviewed staff and conducted focus groups in a lot of the hospitals. And this gave us real insight, really, into how to conduct an ED-led trial, and as well as how research without prior consent panned out. So parents were supportive, and I think that's one of the key things here, is that very few of them actually even noticed that something different was going on in the resus. Even when they did, a very brief conversation between the nurses or doctors and the parents to just say, yes, we are conducting a study. This is a little bit different. Sometimes they noticed the open of the envelope, which was the randomization method we'd used. That very brief conversation to say, this is what's happening. There's some leaflets over there if you really want, but at the moment your child's the focus and we'll come and speak to you. That was sufficient to address any concerns. Where those conversations didn't take place, where the team hadn't picked up on the fact that the parents had noticed something different, there were a few occasions where this is from a recorded trial discussion, where this father would say, what's all the whispering about? What's the dodgy envelope? My kid's unconscious. Tell me what's going on. So that definitely made me feel uncomfortable. Verbal communication at any point is so important. And from this, I would say that in future trials, if you do have it's a condition where there are regular attenders, then it is good to have those brief conversations. But also important, because ethics committees always love a piece of paper. They weren't interested in the piece of paper. They wanted discussion. A key factor that made Eclipse a success was the research question. People really wanted an answer to this research question, and that facilitated buy-in. Another was leadership at site, and also from Perucki. The support that was given motivated people to go above and beyond, really, where there was maybe insufficient cover for the, at weekends for consent. We had a couple of sites that weren't as successful, and that they were cases where there was a lack of leadership at that site. There wasn't buy-in for the study. They were few and far between, but at those sites, they tended to be smaller as well, didn't have the research cover that the bigger sites had. So for future trials, it's really important to cost in properly for research time and research support. So I mentioned we had this really interesting trial discussion data, and we had the interviews as well, and we brought them together. And we thought, okay, what's the best approach of informing how we do this in the future? And we came across this model. This is by Rayal Patel, and it's from their group in Bristol that do a lot around recruitment conversations. And they produced this model to enhance recruitment to clinical trials. So we looked at this, and we thought, does this work for PEM? And we didn't think it did, just because of the sequence. The six steps, I won't read them all out, but we looked at what we had in our data, and it just didn't match at all. So we've remade this model for pediatric emergency meds, and I'll take you through the steps and what order we think is the best way to enhance parental understanding and explain processes within these trials. So step one was explaining the study aims. Whereas Rialp has said to explain the illness, we actually found within the conversations that many of the parents already knew what their child's illness was in this situation. So that wasn't necessary. Study aims first, and then very soon after, explaining research without prior consent and why we couldn't actually seek informed consent beforehand. Having that discussion up front in the conversation helped to alleviate any of those concerns or anxieties about, hold on a minute, what's going on here? What have you done? Step three and step four, they're slightly interlinked. And that's about having a balanced conversation about the drugs that are within the trial and essentially trying to ensure equipoise. We found because Eclipse was unblinded that in the first, say, 6 months of the trial when we were getting all the data in, we found that people were saying, as the quote at the bottom said, so you've got the standard drug. So this, when they got phenytoin, that's great news, you've got the standard drug. Or if they've been given levetiracetam, oh, you've got the new wonder drug. That's fantastic, that's great news. So a brief email and a newspaper, a newsletter to sites to say, please balance these conversations a little bit. We fed back as the trial went on. And immediately after that, when they were coming back through, they were. And that had a knock-on effect. So the parents, when we asked them about the study, were able to recall both different drugs and the pros and cons of both, whereas previously they hadn't. They just thought they got the best one. Randomization is often a very difficult thing to explain. It's a little bit like the offside rule. People have their own explanations of how they do it, and they might use things like a flip of a coin, and it really just confuses people. We found that the envelope that was used in Eclipse, so it was an open envelope, it was pre-filled envelopes, really helped a discussion of randomization to the extent that parents gave us really clear explanations of what randomization was. And they used the same language in the interviews as they had been given by the practitioner in the trial discussions. So, and it was different language than the information sheets. Again, it's that communication that is took on board, prioritised and retained by parents. And the last step is the questions and answers at the end. And I would say, actually, when we get to the next slide, I'll show you the complete model. The questions and answers come throughout, but it was those parents who were asked to recall back by the practitioners, you know, can you just tell me in your own words what Eclipse is about, just to make sure I've explained it clearly to you. Just that was sufficient enough to improve recall. So we'd find that those parents who had those conversations were able to bring that back and to remember. So this is the new adapted six-step model to enhance recruitment in PEM trials. This is about to be submitted, this paper. The previous work that was presented over the last like 8 minutes, they've all been published. So this one should be out soon. And we hope that can give people a little bit more confidence in how to go about these conversations if they do have anxieties about it, and also help inform how protocols and information sheets should be given. Oh, my slides have gone off my screen. So just to finalise, I've mentioned a lot about practitioners, I've spoken about a lot about parents, but what about children? And actually, this is one of my little twins, the 8-year-old at the corner, who loves selfies. We found that in Catch and in Eclipse, the children were just too young to interview. And those that weren't, when I'd say to a parent, is it okay to speak to your child? They would be like, oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I said, do they know that they took part in a trial? And they'd be like, oh, no, we never told them. Okay, I won't interview them then. I'm not going to introduce that one. So we got some funding for the MRC and conducted a study called Voices. And in Voices, we asked children with experience of being admitted to hospital for an emergency care. So a lot of children who had asthma or children with anaphylaxis. And we asked them. We used draw and write methods, and we used a video to help explain research and what we meant by research without prior consent. And they were very clear with their message. So Jack, aged 11, felt that he should definitely be informed about research. As he says, if adults get that privilege, why can't we? Why can't we find out what's happening to us? However, they did say that they were very happy for adults to make decisions on their behalf, and especially when they were sick. But they felt the current practice of maybe there's an information sheet that goes in a mum's handbag was insufficient. And they made the recommendation that we should make an animation that could tell children when they've left hospital, when they're feeling better, all about what's happened. So we did that, and we did that with their help. And if you go on YouTube and look at You Took Part in Research, if you just put that phrase in, it will come up with our animation. And we found it's been accessed a lot over the last year. It's been up there. And it's used to actually explain not only to children about research without prior consent, but people have used it to explain to parents as well and can help depart that sort of family-centred conversation. So final thoughts from me. I think these are the Peruki studies that we've done. We've also done some other studies that I didn't have time to go into that show strong evidence and support for research without prior consent, particularly for those trials that are using interventions that are part of usual care. Any trials that are doing things a bit differently or new and novel interventions, we'd recommend some pre-trial research. And when we've done that, we've been able to tailor information and even the intervention delivery themselves to make it more acceptable. So that pre-trial research involving parents, practitioners, and qualitative research is really important. And finally, please use the resources that are out there. Please write them into your protocols. Please take them to your ethics committees, who still sometimes need convincing. We have this there. And hopefully, we'll be able to continue to progress to get more evidence for paediatric emergency medicine. Thank you. Thank you.